KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Friday, July 10th, 2026. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gonna cheese, hawa, tuxknusum, salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also find us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Today, we speak with Patrick Bringley, author of New York Times bestseller, All the Beauty in the World, the Metropolitan Museum of Art and Me. He has a talk and a signing tonight at the out at UAS Egan Lecture Hall. We have an update from the Juno Community Foundation on some recent grants and marimbas. And Juzu Marimbas is hosting a public concert and workshop this weekend. Those conversations are all coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon. But first, this week's Plinkett Word of the Week.
You're listening to KTOO's Plinkett Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Cushtuck U, Bill Fawcett. And the word this week is yauk.
Yauk.
That means canoe. And here's a sentence. Where is that canoe going? Let's hear it again.
Yauk.
Canoe. Gunas chish to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Cushtuck O'Ish Bill Fawcett was Slukach Adi and the child of a southern Toshone man who passed away before Bill was born. His mother later married Tsihua Bill Fawcett, who helped raise Bill. He lived on Occoquan Ani and enjoyed working with advanced language learners, helping them answer difficult questions about the language.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
Support comes from Nugget Alaskan Outfitter with outdoor clothing, gear, and footwear, including Gruden's deck boots and flip-flops, and extra tough boots for both men and women. Located at the Mendenhall Mall and online at nuggetoutfitter.com.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher. You can also join us on the live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Patrick Bringley is the New York Times best-selling author of All the Beauty in the World, a memoir about the decade he spent working as a guard at the Metropolitan Museum of Art after the devastating loss of his brother Tom. His work served also as the inspiration for an exhibition last year at the City Museum called Slow Beauty. We'll talk a little bit. Okay, we'll get to that. It's still up. He will be at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall tonight at 7 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. It's brought to you by the Juno Douglas City Museum with the help from the Friends of the City Museum and the Juno Community Foundation's Blackwell Fund. It's Patrick's first visit to Alaska, and it's an honor to welcome him, as well as of yesterday, I guess we say as of today, the former executive director of the City Museum, Beth Weigel. Gunath Cheesh, Hayedi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you here. Beth, welcome in. Wasiti, how are you?
Mm-hmm. Yake. I'm doing pretty good, despite all of the drama of the last bit of time here at the city. But I'm really happy to still be here. I'm a free agent now.
You're
producing
free
all
agent.
Kinds of things, yeah.
Yeah, that's so great. And then Patrick, welcome to Alaska. Gunath Cheesh, Wasiti, how are you?
Oh, I am wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
Excellent. So let's just get the particulars out of the way. The talk is tonight at the Egan Lecture Hall, 7 p.m. So it's not at the City Museum.
But although I will add that he's going to be at the City Museum tomorrow, Saturday, at 11 a.m. We'll have a little meet, greet, and eat. And he's not going to do any talking there. But, I mean, he'll talk to people. He just won't give a presentation there. So if you want to come and meet him tomorrow morning as well, you can check
So if you
in
can't
there.
Make it tonight. Is tonight going to be streamed or archived in any way?
No, we're just doing it.
Just doing it. Okay, great. Just making it happen.
That's right.
I love that. Well, thank you for you both being here. It's really awesome. So, Patrick, this book, New York Times bestseller, All the Beauty in the World. I want to get into the history a little bit first, and we'll talk. Then later we'll talk about what's going to happen tonight. But what were you doing before you found out that your brother had cancer? What was your life like before that?
Sure. I was working at the New Yorker magazine. I wasn't writing for them. I was in their events office.
Okay.
But I was up in this, you know, skyscraper, and I was just 22 years old when I got that job, and I kind of thought, you know, this is it. I've made it. But things really did change when my brother got sick.
Yeah, okay. So then your brother Tom got diagnosed with cancer, and that was it a long journey with that?
Yeah, he was sick for a little under 3 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. And did you have to participate in the care and the giving of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was married, and my parents would come into town. He was in New York City. I'm from outside Chicago. So it's not as if that fell on my shoulders, but I certainly spent loads of time both at his apartment in Queens and in hospital rooms.
Yeah, I mean, it affected you deeply, obviously, because after his passing, what happened? You decided to just change it all up. Was his passing the sort of inciting action to you changing everything?
Yeah, I just didn't want to rush back to some office job and be answering emails and worrying about kind of nonsense or corporate ladder climbing or whatever else. I had spent all this time in these hospital rooms, seeing something that felt, you know, very elemental and very sort of basic and also very beautiful. Mm. And I was kind of shell-shocked and speechless, and I knew of this job, being a guard at this beautiful place where I could just kind of stand still for a while longer and sort of think my thoughts and commune with these beautiful things.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about, is how did the idea of being a security guard go from, you know, sort of being an event, you know, working with events at New Yorker magazine to being a security guard. How did you hear about that job? Was it people that you knew who were already doing it?
Yeah, I always loved art. So I had been to the Met a lot. I had noticed those guards standing in the corner. But also I just had a work study job at NYU in their art history library. And the head of that library had been a guard. And he sort of just implanted the idea of the job in my mind.
I see. Okay. And was it the simplicity of the job, or sort of the quietness of the job that kind of, because I know you talk about that a little bit in terms of what that brought to you, but was that sort of the allure of sort of taking that position? Was it you didn't have to interact with a lot of people? And I mean, you got to see people, but you were really standing there with the art.
Yes. I loved the idea of just the sort of straightforwardness and honesty of the job. You know, I didn't want to do something that felt BS-y at all. Mm. And I also just relished, that sort of ghost-like aspect of it. You know, you don't have to, no boss is pushing you around, and you can commune with these things, and you can watch some people and sort of, I don't know, disappear into this world that's a lot bigger than yourself.
Yeah, I know. I was watching an interview that you had done, and you were talking. They were asking you about, you know, I think there's like 500 guards that work throughout all of the Met, and so that there's an all kinds of people who do that job. And so I'm imagining that you got to meet a wide variety of people and stories that are happening throughout all of New York City with people who are working at the Met as security guards.
Oh my word, yes. I mean, I think at the beginning, what I really prized was this sort of just being quiet and in the corner by myself. But certainly as it progressed and I became more of a veteran on the job, the people are just such an appeal. I mean, as you mentioned, there are 500 guards. They're from every country you can imagine because, you know, New York City is 40% foreign born. And I'd guess 60% of the guards are foreign born.
Mm.
And not only are they from these different places, they've done everything with their lives. Partially because they came to the job later, many of them, from different countries. It's not just one type of person that becomes a museum security guard. You know, all sorts of roads can kind of lead to that. So you meet people who are intellectuals and artists and who are, you know, veterans and have driven cabs and flown airliners and just done everything.
Wow.
And it creates just really unusual. I mean, there's just not many places in life where you just, there's this catch-all of all types of human beings that are wearing the same suit of clothes. So just meet each other on absolutely equal footing and you can just stand next to them and sort of shoot the breeze and learn their life stories over the course of a long, slow day. I miss it. I really miss that aspect of the job.
So I'm curious, you mentioned sort of the beginning and then sort of, you know, you became more of a veteran worker because you worked there for 10 years, I guess, right? But I'm just curious, like, so you took the job and like right at the beginning, you know, what was those first couple months like? What was that? Can you remember what those first couple months were in terms of that transition that you made into working?
Oh, vividly. I mean, the very first day I meet this guard who's a veteran that I'm going to be shadowing. And I just remember, so she's this tall Finnish woman and she is, you know, showing me the ropes and this and that and the other thing. And then in the afternoon, she's like, okay, I leave you here. And she just leaves me and then she wanders away. And then you look around and you're like, wow, this is my job. You know, I'm not busy. I don't have my hands empty. I don't have my head down looking at, or I do have my hands empty. I don't, you know, have my head down looking at anything. I have my head up. And I'm just seeing what happens moment to moment. And it was just, I was so grateful for it. It's just this incredible sort of extraordinary gift where you're spending 8 or 12 hour days in Egypt one day and the old master paintings the next day and all over that building. And I think in those first few months, I just, it was the quiet of it, the stillness of it, and just this almost dreamlike feeling that you are, you know, inside these El Greco paintings.
So you, the job is I'm imagining, I was a security guard, but not in a museum when I was much younger, at an apple juice farm where they, apples, it was crazy. But like this idea seemed like, are these the guards that you see at the museum who are just making sure that people aren't crossing the line or touching the art or, you know, just keeping the peace basically of what's going on. So there is really, most people are pretty respectful. So I imagine that gives you a lot of time because you're seeing not only people walk through and the wonder that they're getting from the artwork and the worlds that they're seeing, but then also you being able to be part of that and be in there and you also getting that tranquility of with the art. So I'm just curious, like, is that, was it interesting to see the people flowing through as well and all the different types of people that you were witnessing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Met, 7 million people come to the Met every year. I mean, more people come to the Met than all of the New York sports teams combined. And over the course of a given day, of course, like you said, the vast majority of people are very respectful. You occasionally are going to have to, you know, reprimand someone who's touching the statues or things like that. But mostly those things just take little minutes out of your day. And then you have these hours to people watch and to watch the art. In fact, one of the early things a veteran told me, he said, the way you work this job is when you get bored of the people, you look at the art. When you get bored of the art, back to the people. And that is a sort of dance you play.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because you get tourists from all over the world. You get New Yorkers. The Met has regulars. There are people who come, you know, more or less every week.
Yeah.
Who you get to know. One, you know, this guy Daryl gives Christmas cards to the guards. So it is just this, it's this world in there.
That's awesome. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. We're talking to Patrick Bringley, author of All the Beauty in the World, a memoir about the decade he spent working as a guard at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He's going to be speaking tonight at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall at 7 p.m. So getting back to the book, when was the idea to write the book? When did that come up?
I had always been, you know, scribbling little notes. I'm just someone who does that. I didn't get the idea to write like a whole book until, I don't know, 6 years in or something.
Wow.
But my first idea was to write a guard's guide to the Met. That's what I was calling it in my mind.
Yeah.
Where I just write little things about the art and, you know, anecdotes about things I overhear and backstage stories and things. But I started to write that, and it just was kind of a mess. You know, it's just a bunch of bric-a-brac that you're putting in a book. And eventually it occurred to me, well, the type of art book that there's not a lot of are stories, you know, a personal story mm-hmm. about the subjective experience of being with this stuff, mm-hmm. as opposed to just a little information on, you know, Velázquez or things. But what is it like to stand in front of those things? What sort of draws us into this museum in the first place? Mm. And once I got that idea, I realized that it would have to be a memoir. So it took me years to realize, to learn how to write such a thing.
Yeah.
And by degrees, I realized, oh, well, this is going to have to be about me. It's going to have to be about my brother, too. And I'm going to have to, you know, sort of have recurring characters and just sort of teach myself how to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Were there pieces in the museum that, maybe you cover this in the book, but were there pieces that started to speak to you differently after, you know, a number of years that you would see the first couple months and then years later you'd be like, oh, I see something else in there now. How did the art affect your brain that way?
Oh, without question. I mean, you grow relationships with these things, partially just because if you're looking at an oil painting, I mean, it is oftentimes ground up earth and stones and vegetable matter and insects mixed with linseed oil. And it's just, there's so much there. There's tens of thousands of brush strokes. But then also just in sort of peculiar ways, you'll just have looked at a painting for hours and hours and you'll come in one day and it'll just, something about the color harmonies just strikes you as impossibly rich and sort of lush in a way that it never had before.
Yeah.
Because it takes a certain openness on your part. It takes a sort of lack of glibness on your part. And sometimes that comes very slowly. Because first, when you look at a painting, you kind of get in the way of the painting itself, your own thoughts, your own sort of, you know, suppositions about the thing. And then also some paintings too, and sculptures and everything else, they grow in sort of importance to you because they seem to be about something, you know? It's not just the formal aspects of the painting, but you're looking at the passion or something, and you've just suffered a loss, and you say, wow, this is a picture about suffering, and this is a picture about, you know, death, and there's Mary holding her grown son in her lap. And the sort of profundity of that sometimes can take, you know, months or years to sort of sink into you.
Wow, that's amazing. And Beth, I mentioned in the intro that this book and a few other things were inspirational for an exhibit that is still up at the museum called Slow Beauty. How did this book affect the idea of doing the exhibit of Slow Beauty?
Well, it came in a variety of ways. I had originally listened to the book as an audiobook, which Patrick narrates, and it does a wonderful job. And you know, I do that listening in the car back and forth to town, and I loved it because I wanted to know about museums and art because I worked in a museum, and then, you know, things happen in your life like Patrick said, right? And I had a loss. My sister died, and other things happened, and they were difficult. And I had been in Denver, and I was visiting a friend. I'd just come from seeing my parents, who my sister had taken, you know, primary care of, and now I was trying to do it from a distance. And I went to Denver after I'd seen them in Iowa and went down to the Contemporary Museum of Art and just walked around all day. And it's a lot of abstract stuff, you know, it's not so, it's just like textures and colors and sometimes fibers in it and all sorts of things. And I just stood there and looked and looked and looked and looked. And and then I was tired and I went up to the rooftop and I remembered this book that I had read, and I was like, okay, this is a lot more meaningful in that this idea of just being with art rather than trying to understand any history about it or anything about the artist or anything other than just being in an experience with this art. And so when I, you know, we talked about different things and something didn't happen for that small room that we call the media room, and I said, well, what do you think about doing this? Let's do this. Let's just get out the pieces we love the most in the museum and the collection, because we're mostly known as a history museum. And so a lot of times, you know, we're telling historical stories and we don't get out the art as often as we should. And So we all just like went through and picked out the different things that we loved the most. And, you know, mine is the Sidney Lawrence Supper on the Bar, and somebody else really loved that Cormorants by Zagers. And we just picked out the things we loved. And there's only six things that we picked, but, you know, because it's a very small room. And I had written a article about it in the newsletter as well. And I went back and listened to the book again and, you know, resonated very differently in that way. And sort of did a little research and thinking about what slow looking is in the art world and that practice and how that translates into, you know, sort of an international movement. Mm. There was a slow looking day, I think, or some slow art day, I think they call it, in March or something. So just, you know, and it doesn't have to be necessarily art, but, you know, I had experienced a lot of that kind of feeling when I was out in nature, you know, because here we spend a lot of time outside. And so just being and seeing and looking and slowing down, all of that was very appealing after going through a lot of stressful things. And, you know, the stressful things hadn't really stopped, you know, so more things happen. And so it gives you, I think, the things that resonated for me from the book, or like, it's not really so much learning a skill as like just sort of like slowing down and stopping and allowing yourself to like take care of yourself when there's stress in your life, like, you know, getting laid off from your job.
It seems like that's really important in this day and age, right, where we're trapped by our phones or technology or whatnot, and just to be able to stand still or stand in a museum and be one with what's going on in there and let that sort of wash over you and let you reflect and have that time. I think that's really cool. But you didn't stop there, Patrick, which I think is really interesting. I have a theater background, and so when I saw this part, I was like, whoa, this is kind of cool. So then you decided to turn this into a solo play, a performance. How did that all begin?
Well, I've been giving, first let me just say, spending time in the exhibit in the City Museum, oh my God, it just fills me up. It's such an honor, and also those pieces are so beautiful. To answer your question, I had been giving talks at museums and, you know, in auditoriums, and I sort of liked doing it, and I realized, well, there's something a little more ambitious that could happen here, because there's something about natural about a one-man show about a lonesome security guard, and we could do something cool with projections and sort of be inside this sort of sacred place of a museum. A theater is kind of like a museum in a way too. And then I had met at this literary festival in Charleston, South Carolina, this man, Dominic Dromgoole, who ran the Globe Theater in London for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And has just directed a million shows, this British guy. And we hit it off, and I pitched him the idea, and he read the book, and he said, that's interesting, send me some pages, and it was off to the races.
Wow.
So we did it first in Charleston, South Carolina. That's where we met. So we did the following year there, and then we did this run of 65 shows off Broadway last year.
Oh, wow. And you have plans to do it again?
Hopefully. Yeah, I don't have there's interest in a London production with another actor, which would be cool for me.
Yeah.
And then there's perhaps other places where we don't have the contracts inked, but in the U.S.
Yeah, that's really cool. And you no longer work at the museum as a security guard. So what are you doing with yourself these days besides traveling to Alaska and giving wonderful talks to our locals here?
Yes. Well, happily, that's a lot of what I do these days. You know, I'm so lucky as an author, because most authors, you write a book and where do you talk? Like a Barnes & Noble, a library? Mm. They don't fly to Alaska to talk at a Barnes & Noble. But it's amazing that every city in this country has museums that they're proud of, and every museum has volunteers and docents and members and that just love these places. Mm. And I'm so lucky that I get to tap into that and show up and give talks. And I'm working on another book. I'm working on a couple other projects. And I give private tours of the Met to a lot of book clubs and things.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, because I was thinking, like, when you're you went as a security guard and the book comes in later and then it turns into this memoir and then you write the book, it gets published. And I'm sure that's a whole difficult process too. But then I'm like, what do you think? When did you decide, okay, this is the next thing I want to do? Was writing a thing that you said, okay, now I'm going to be a writer and I'm going to travel and talk to folks about this? And, you know, is that just happen organically, or was it something that you planned?
Well, I had to be extraordinarily lucky to make that the book did well.
Yeah.
Because most books don't do well.
Right.
So if the book didn't do well, then back to something. Yeah. I really didn't know what that something would be.
Yeah.
But you know, it takes some hustle too. You know, you just kind of out there at the beginning, just trying to get people to pay attention, and you give talks and things for free and stuff at the beginning. I don't know quite what I pictured, but I've always wanted to write in some capacity. Mm-hmm. So as long as this did anything, I was probably going to try to work on a new book.
Can you give us a tease about what the new book's about?
Yeah. That my working title of it is First Do Nothing, How to See. So it's along some of the same lines that we've been talking about, which is I do think that whether you're looking at art or whether you're looking at these mountains out here, sort of the first thing you have to do is step outside of the normal sort of flow of life that gives you a sort of narrowed focus, and you're focused on the thing you got to do, then the next thing you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of have to stand back. And sometimes you think, like, my God, what a strange and mysterious existence this is, and how much beauty and how much sorrow and how much depth. And you just you begin to receive in a way. And I think there are other things, though, that you also can do to engage more fully with both art and also the world around us, the same sort of world that the artists themselves are seeing.
Mm.
So the book is about that. And it's my sort of journey to make myself better at that, because Lord knows I'm not some sort of expert, you know, talking down to you. In fact, I'm speaking to people who look at things in the world with as much attention as some people look at Rembrandt paintings.
Right. Oh, that's really cool. And where can we follow your journey? I know you have a website. Is it patrickbringley.com?
Yeah, if you just Google me, patrickbringley.com. Yeah.
Yeah, excellent. And of course, you can find everything that's going on at the museum at juno.gov/museum. Beth, it was such a wonderful thing to have you as the leader of that organization. We value our city museum greatly, and hopefully things can turn around and we can get the museum back up to full staff sometime soon.
Yeah, and now that I don't, you know, work at the city, I can tell everybody that you need to definitely support your museum and get out there and tell your city leaders and your assembly members that you want your museum back, because I've always said it's the community's museum. It's your stories, it's our stories, it's everyone's stories. Everyone's voice belongs there, and your voice can be heard to bring it back.
Absolutely. Here.
Yeah, Gunnath Cheesh for being here today. Patrick Bringley tonight, 7 p.m. out at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall. Really appreciate you being here today, Gunnath Cheesh.
Thank you so much.
This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
This is Bird Note. Helmeted guinea fowl are sometimes kept as ornamental birds in zoos and farmyards around the world. But from Senegal to South Africa, where the birds are native, their raucous calls are a familiar sound. Helmeted guinea fowl are chicken-sized birds whose round black bodies are covered in tiny white speckles. In stark contrast, their heads are bald, blue, and adorned with a keratinous horn-like helmet on top. They're known for running about in social flocks, squawking as they go, perpetually panic-stricken about something. These are calls of alarm, warning all members of the flock that a predator approaches. In their native range, guinea fowl are favored prey of wildcats and martial eagles. Because they're also spooked by unfamiliar people, guinea fowl are often employed as burglar alarms on farms. Guinea fowl are related to chickens and pheasants, and like them, they lay a lot of eggs, up to a dozen in a nest. The chicks are cute balls of fluff that rapidly grow into gawky juveniles. Helmeted guinea fowl are easily domesticated, but they'll always remain flighty, squawky, birds in a panic. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Tongass Federal Credit Union, a member-owned financial cooperative offering checking and savings accounts, loans, and digital financial services. In Juno at 8585 Old Dairy Road in the K Plaza and at tongassfcu.com. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hanson Gress, ka eat with the shoe ye, we ka shook a ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakhaya ha anikak gunish cheese.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO, live from Studio 2K, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson. I'm Boston Christopher. The Juno Community Foundation recently awarded almost $3 million in social service grants through the Juno Hope / CBJ Endowment Grant. I'm joined now by Amy Skillbred, leader of the Juno Community Foundation, to tell us more about that and many other things. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Boston. How are you doing?
Good with cheese for being here. I really appreciate it. Happy Friday.
Yes, happy Friday.
Yeah, so exciting news, right?
Yeah, it's great. It's great. A lot of reasons it's great. It's great that we have a Hope Endowment that can bring $1 million-some a year to social service grants. And it's great that the City and Borough of Juneau was able to provide the same amount of funding as they have in past years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that really helped keep it at just about $3 million.
Oh, that's amazing.
Which is fantastic.
And yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, since about 2015, it's been $22 million overall. So not an insignificant amount of money that's been going in to support our social services.
And these are specifically for social service nonprofit agencies here in Juneau.
Social service nonprofit agencies, correct. Also, hospice up at Bartlett, sometimes other programs at Bartlett, social workers or caseworkers, social workers at the schools to assist with mental health, mostly is what it's been at the schools.
I see. So, okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these were awarded. When did these awards get announced?
So we announced the awards a little while ago, but we didn't know if we would have all the money from CBJ. So really, June 9th was about the announcement to say, yes, we have the money and the awards are going to go out. And so letters have gone out to 21 different organizations.
Wow, and, 21.
Yeah, supporting everything from youth shelter and kin support group to senior services, SAIL, Big Brothers Big Sisters, AWARE, REACH, the Juno Housing First Collaborative, Glory Hall.
Wow.
Alaska Legal Services.
Sounds like every organization in town almost.
Yeah, I should have the whole list. Yeah, I do have it.
That is great.
So it's interesting
because what would you feel the landscape of the social service agencies would be without the Hope Endowment and the CBJ grant?
It would be, we would have a whole lot less organizations.
Yeah.
I mean, we have some organizations that without the funds that are coming through the Juno Community Foundation, ours and the city's, we would not have a youth shelter. We would not have an emergency shelter. We would, not have as much support from Alaska Legal Services. Big Brothers Big Sisters wouldn't be here in town or might not be here. I mean, there's a lot of, a lot of the work that NAMI Juno does. So I think, mental health, substance abuse, victims of violence, people who are struggling. Mm-hmm. And that's the funding that we provide to support that. We don't have, in the year 2000, the city closed their health and social service department. And then they had some funds that they gave out for a while. And then they moved funds and have since increased the amount of funds that they give out through the Community Foundation.
I see. Yeah. So, and it's interesting because I feel like the community really steps up in supporting the social service agencies that we have. A lot of people contribute, volunteer, all those kinds of things. Can you give me the origins of the HOPE Endowment? Like, where did that come from?
The HOPE Endowment was started by Bill Corbis and Katie Corbis, and it came from the funds of the sale of AELMP. And so that is an endowment that began at about $20 million, and so it enables us to give out $1 million a year. And since then, we've also had other bequests from people that have died and left funds, legacy funds, to the Juneau Community Foundation for homelessness, and that's enabled us to support Juneau Nonprofit Housing Development Council, which we help pull people together who actually house people who are homeless or otherwise would be homeless. And looking at how to basically build housing that's needed for people who have basically no income.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we do that? And so we have funds for that. The community is incredibly supportive of our Feeding Juneau Kids Fund. And so being able to provide, you know, weekend food bags for 750 kids every weekend.
Wow.
And Gastineau Human Services, is sort of an amazing story, has taken that on. It was started by a woman up in the, worked with Douglas Community United Methodist Church. And then Kim Poole ran it for a while and then really needed a larger group of people who could carry totes that were pretty heavy. And so looking around, Gastineau Human Services stepped up and said, we'll do it. And so we provide them with the funds to buy the food or get the food. And then they have workers and people who live with, you know, live at Gastineau Human Services who all participate in filling bags because you got to do it every weekend during the school year.
Wow.
It's a lot.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, so it's been great.
Because I was going to say, for those who maybe don't know the Juneau Community Foundation, this is a foundation that manages so many funds.
Right.
You can go to junocf.org and see all the different funds that are available. Yeah. And we hear about, okay, the social service agencies get some grants and things like that, and it comes from these endowment funds. But what can I do as an individual to help in a situation? Can I donate to the Feeding the Kids of Juneau Fund, or how does that work?
Yeah, so when people want to make, you know, monthly or other donations, we are, you know, we greatly accept them. Every year we do a push with a matching grant for Feeding Juneau Kids. And so I think this year there'll be a $50,000 matching grant, and we will start that probably in October. And that's sort of our, every year, a lot of nonprofits have an end of year letter, and that's what ours is about. Our fundraising campaign is Feeding Juneau Kids.
I see.
And so
okay.
we do that. I would say also is just support your favorite nonprofit social service organization directly.
Yeah.
That's huge. And like you said, it's always needed, and people are very generous in this town. And so that's, you know, critical and important.
And of course, full disclosure, Juneau Community Foundation manages the K2O Legacy Fund, which is our endowment fund that's been over there at the Community Foundation for a number of years. And it helps us greatly. As you know, our community stepped up to support K2O
Absolutely.
After federal funding was lost last year. This community is the gratitude we feel for that is just amazing. And I'm sure these social service agencies feel the same about the HOPE CBJ grant.
Yeah, and luckily with KTO, we were able to, we have another fund, the Juneau Capital Fund with an OL, that was able to help with Gavel, Alaska. And that really, you know, helps to make sure that we are the capital city and able to tell other people in the state what's happening at the Capitol.
Yeah, a lot of people sometimes don't recognize that Gavel is a K2O production. It's done here at downstairs. We have a bunch of people who work during that time of year, and it's a wonderful service, and it goes statewide over there at 360 TV.
Right.
You can watch it all the time and keep up to date on what's going on in your government, for sure. I also want to mention that you have some other funds that are coming up for renewal soon. Or are in the process of application right now. We had some people on to talk about the Arts Vibrancy Fund, but tell me your take on that.
So I was going to say the Juno Arts Vibrancy Fund, we are giving out $30,000 in that area, and artists are invited to participate by sending us an application. Go on to junocf.org, and you'll see a big new post right on the front that says, are you an artist? And, you know, do you want money?
I think that's a yes from most of the artists, I would think, yeah.
And then it's got a August 15th date, I think, that applications have to be in by.
Yeah, and we talked when the folks were on a few weeks ago, we were talking about the various different things that people could apply for in there as an individual artist or as a group or with a group. You can have any kind of project almost that you want. Right. Musicians have been helped. Plays and playwrights have been helped. Artists have been helped to do solo gallery shows, things like that. All kinds of stuff has been done through this. So don't limit yourself. That's what I would say, is don't limit yourself in terms of what you think you might be able to get supported as an artist through this Vibrancy Fund.
Yeah, definitely. And give us a call.
Yeah.
You know, contact us, email at info@junocf.org or grants at, and let us, you know, we can talk with you. We'd be happy to talk with you and figure out, you know, does what you want to do fit and where else might you look? Besides us or along with us kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, and I know that some people are, you know, fearful of writing a grant. They've never done it before. Yeah. And it's like I feel like last time the folks were saying it was they've made it really easy.
Right.
Basically, you need like a one page, couple paragraphs or whatever it is, plus a little bit of a budget to understand like where you're going to spend the money, that kind of thing. So it's not a long, complicated process.
Correct. It's not. And, you know, the grant applications get a bit longer the more money that is being given out, because when you start giving out $100,000 chunks and stuff, like in the Hope CBJ one, you're asking for a bit more information than, you know, closer to, you know, $5,000 ones.
So back to the Hope CBJ grants in terms of the social services, what is the range? You were just mentioning the sort of, are they operating funds? Are they specific for projects, or is it a wide range of support that's available for these?
Wide range, and a lot of operating funds.
Yeah.
And, you know, ranges from everything from 30,000 to 600 some thousand. So.
Whoa.
It just depends. And part of that was there are funds we look at every year. We actually have interim reports that are due and final reports. And I do have people who ask me, they say, well, you know, is all this money doing what it needs to do kind of thing? And the answer is it does. And it changes people's lives, and it's, you know, hard to think, okay, that's a lot of money to change people's lives. But when you have, you know, like a story from Gastineau Human Services that, you know, someone who was on opioids and stimulants lost everything but his truck, he got to Gastineau Human Services, progressed well in treatment, had a relapse prevention plan, reconciled with his family, started studying to get his pilot's license, and has now obtained a permanent employment on the North Slope.
And amazing.
So, yeah. So it's hard to live with a mental illness. It's hard to live with a substance misuse. And being able to get help and being at the point that you want help and go and get it, it's good that we have these organizations in town that can make that happen.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
When you need it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Those kind of stories that individual stories, you know, that you get because all these agencies are helping individuals do things, you know.
Yeah. There's another one, a woman and her husband, they'd been living with addiction for over 20 years. The wife had a brain injury and serious illness, and they'd lost their house and their jobs. They were living in their van before they lost that as well. They had a lot of stress and conflict going on in, you know, between them as well. And there were domestic violence disputes and arrest. And then they got to Juno Housing First Collaborative and were able to work with the navigator and the outreach coordinator there, and as well as Search, that has a medical team that is a mobile medical team.
Mm.
she was able to stabilize, and she moved into the Forget-Me-Not Manor and has lived there for several months and is thriving.
That's amazing.
You know, biking, cleaning up the area, doing positive things. And so, you know, they're both doing better. And these types of success stories really show that despite initial reluctance sometimes on the part of people to get assistance, when they do and they sort of commit to it, it can really change people's lives around.
That's amazing.
So, thank you to everybody who gives.
Yeah, really, really, it is. Yeah. It is. It's those who help others who may not be able to help themselves or are not in a place to help themselves at that moment.
Right.
And these grants are wonderful for that. There's so many programs available through the Juno Community Foundation. You have a wonderful website, junocf.org, where you can learn all about the different funds, the different projects, because these are just a couple of the things that are on the docket.
Lots of parks, trails, and recreation things.
Yeah.
Hilda Dam Cabin, Treadwell Ditch Cabin. Oh, and the new Mendenhall Lake Cabin. We were able to had a generous bequest of $100,000 that we were able to put towards that cabin and sort of and meet the federal requirement for matching funds.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
excellent.
And now there's going to be a second Mendenhall cabin over by the park, the camping area.
Oh, okay.
And the skaters' cabin area.
Oh, yeah, right.
Beautiful views of the lake and the glacier.
That's so
cool. And the morning that was opened up to the public, it was gone. You know, every night was gone until the end of, I don't know if they do 6 months or what, but it was like, okay, you couldn't get anything.
Yeah, there's no
2 hours
room
later,
left.
You
yeah.
couldn't get anything.
Yeah, I know those cabins go fast, man. They
That's
go
amazing.
Fast. And I know our last guest who was on here, Patrick Bringley, the Blackwell Fund comes through. What is the Blackwell Fund?
Well, Mike Blackwell lived in Juneau growing up, went away and had a career elsewhere, came back to Juneau and started the Blackwell Fund. And it was a donor advised fund, and he wanted funds from it to go to things that he was interested in. And the Juneau Douglas City Museum was one, and he gave money a while ago to help them buy, you know, display cases and things like that.
Oh, cool.
And they had requested funds to bring Patrick up, and I could reach out now to his sons, because Mike has since died. And his sons are the advisors on it, and said, hey, you guys interested in helping out with this? And they said, absolutely, sure. And so it enables us to do things like that.
I love that.
It's really cool.
It's so cool. Amy Skilbrad from the Juneau Community Foundation, thank you so much for being here. Gunath Cheesh, I really appreciate it. Congratulations to all the Hope CBJ Fund recipients. And you can find out more about what's going on over there at the Juneau Community Foundation at junocf.org. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
Gunath Cheesh, I appreciate it. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Emil Mackey at Country Financial, offering insurance for home, auto, and business, and life insurance to protect your family in case of death. Located in the Juno Nugget Mall. More information can be found online or by calling 907-500-7017. Juno Afternoon from KTOO. That right there is an awesome driving tune called No Paper from Standing Stones by local artist Marion Call. Unfortunately, Betsy is not going to be able to be here to tell us a little bit about the Marimbas workshop and concert that's going on this weekend, but I did want to tell you a little bit about what's happening with that, and then we'll hear a story from Morning Edition host Mike Lane. The Juno Marimba Intensive Final Performance featuring student groups, teachers, and Njuzu Marimba will be happening this Sunday, July 12th. It looks like it's at 6:30 as doors open, 7 p.m. show over there in Douglas at Perseverance Theater. It's pay what you can. And the profits, 100% of the profits from the performance will go to Tururu, a nonprofit organization in Zimbabwe that works to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS by educating young women and girls. There's also a workshop that's available that's going to be happening. It starts tonight. I don't think there's many spots left, but you can always reach out to Betsy at, I think it's in marimbas@gmail.com, junomarimbas@gmail.com, one of those. Get on her list for all these cool workshops and concerts that she does with marimbas. It's pretty awesome. So that is the Juno Marimba Intensive Final Performance this Sunday, July 12th at Perseverance Theater at 7 o'clock. Pay as you can. Now, for almost three decades, the Southeast Alaska Food Bank has served people in Juneau, as well as other Southeast communities. KTO's Morning Edition host Mike Lane visited with Dan Parks, the executive director of the food bank, about the organization's beginnings, how it works, and how you, as a community member, can help.
For people who might not be familiar with the Southeast Alaska Food Bank, can you describe how it works and who can access it?
Sure. Yeah, that's a common question. Get that a lot. And it's not so straightforward as one might think. We have currently about 40 member agencies, and we distribute food to those member agencies Monday through Thursday, all week, each week. These are things like the Glory Hall, Jammy, Aware, Housing First, many churches, you go on and on. And all of these qualifying organizations that we distribute food to then in turn redistribute that food to their target population. We also operate a weekly public pantry that is accessible to anybody, no questions asked. It's every Thursday afternoon from 3 to 5:30 p.m.
How did you get involved in the food bank in Juneau?
I fell into it like many of my colleagues did as well. I came to Juneau originally as a guide, but then I fell into nonprofit work. I worked for SAIL, Southeast Alaska Independent Living, for a couple years with their ORCA program, the Outdoor Recreation Community Access Program. And I just found I really liked doing nonprofit work, helped me sleep at night, you know. So after I left SAIL, I wanted to stay in nonprofit work, but I wasn't real sure what I wanted to do. And the food bank was hiring for a part-time driver, warehouse manager. I thought, that sounds like a job I'd like to do for a little while. And I did it for about a week before I ended up being promoted. And now I'm running the food bank, yeah.
What do you enjoy about working there?
I love my team, the people that I work with, both the staff and the volunteers and the board for that matter. It's all about the people. And on that note, you know, it's also about the patrons, the people that we interact with that are using the food bank or using food bank services. Handing somebody a bag of food is something that you can walk away from knowing that's an instantaneous positive impact on somebody's life.
When did the food bank in Juneau start, and do you know how and why?
It was officially incorporated as a 501c3 nonprofit in 1999. It started a little bit before that. A guy named Jim Wilcox, local guy, still around, started it. He noticed that there were just more and more people dumpster diving, and he just thought, there's got to be a better way. Rather than throw this food in the dumpster, maybe we can gather it up, collect it, and take it somewhere. So Jim and his buddies, they just started doing it. It began very organically, very naturally.
How many people does the food bank serve now as far as community members?
Each week, you know, we expect to see a certain number of the general public come down And most weeks, it's about 500. We expect to see somewhere in the ballpark of 120 to 160 households visit us each week, which, you know, every household is three or four, five people.
Sure.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So that leads into this next question. What are the current needs of the food bank and how can community members help?
Always the thing that we need the most is just donations, food, cash, any sort of support, whether it's hard goods or financial support. That goes a long way for us. Donations, private donations of food that come into us. Often that's the only way that we can source a lot of products. You know, we buy a lot of food. We're buying more and more food as demand rises. And there's things that are easy for me to buy. Staple foods like rice and pasta, peanut butter and tuna. Those things I can get easily in bulk. But other things, you know, canned meats, cereals, shelf-stable milk, those are the things that we really need the most.
I wonder about the summer season when we have a lot of tourists and people who work in the tourism industry. Are you seeing a lot of those transient workers come to the food bank or visit the other distribution centers as well?
Historically, we've always expected summer to be our slow season. However, over the last year or two, we've kind of broken the mold. Summer has continued to be as busy as spring or winter, and it's just kind of continually growing our demand. The simple answer is the demand just keeps growing regardless of what season we're in.
That was KTO's Morning Edition host Mike Lane talking with Southeast Alaska Food Bank Director Dan Parks. You can catch Mike every morning, Monday through Friday, from about 5 in the morning till 8:30 or 9 so in the morning. So catch him out. Catch him every Monday through Friday. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. That's going to do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Wishing you all a happy and wonderful weekend here in Juno. Get out and do something fun. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. You can find the show online at kto.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives over on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, Country Financial, and Tongass Federal Credit Union. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gonna cheese. Have a fantastic weekend.